Page one, paragraph one.
That is the evil laugh of a person who just made me read an entire book about fossils.
The OG fossils.
The OG fossils, yes, absolutely.
I mean, I feel like prior to this book,
there were no fossils.
There were no fossils on the page.
I agree. This is like the Big Bang of fossils, maybe.
Yes, exactly. The reason why you don't like fossils is because no one writes fossils like this. Look, it's a lot of fossils.
I did skimmed over a lot of like Ice Age versus Big Flood talk the same way.
I remember skimming that part.
The four humors, or you know why it's important to wash your hands or whatever.
Hey, listen, I get it. I get it, and we're gonna get into it.
Oh yeah.
But first of all, welcome everyone to Fate and Mates. I'm Sarah McLean. I read romance novels and I write them.
Jennifer Prokop. I am a romance reader, critic, and editor. Avowed fossil lover. Kidding. I'm not that last thing. I'm the other ones.
And we're going to get into why we started talking about fossils. Some of you know, some of you don't, but we're going to learn today. This week, we read Amanda Quick's Ravished, and it was as much of a delight for me now as it was when I read it the first time in 1996.
Is it 1996? I thought it was 1992.
Well, yes, but I read it in college.
You read it later.
I can remember reading this book in college and being like, blue stockings are the tits.
Yeah. Fair. Fair. I remember reading these books. I don't have like a vivid memory of reading. Like, you know what? It's not like tagged to like a, I was in this place or whatever.
No, but these books with the covers.
Oh, yeah.
The scripty font and the pastels and the. So Amanda Quick began her time. Well, she began her time as Stephanie James, I think.
And Jane Castle.
And Jane, well, she's Jane Ann Krentz. It's hard to sort of see. She's Jane Ann Krentz and Amanda Quick. Jane Ann Krentz is the contemporary author, and that's her real name.
Mm-hmm.
And then there's Amanda Quick, who is the historical version of the Jane Ann Krentz, historical flavor. And then there is Jane Castle.
If you'll remember from our Sandra Brown episode, these authors all wrote for different publishers, and they all had different pen names for different publishers. So I think some of the early ones were probably more like, I think Stephanie James was Silhouette. I think Jane Castle was Harlequin or whatever.
Well, Stephanie James was Silhouette number one. So, yeah, so she started fresh with them.
Yeah, so I think some of those pen names probably were dependent on, because, you know, contemporary. She was writing category romance, because that's what
everybody's
doing.
But Jane Castle did do those space books.
Yes. Yeah. Starfire.
The OG space books.
Yeah. So I think some of, and then, you know, it's really interesting because now she mostly writes as Jane Ann Krentz. But even this book, like, unlike Sandra Brown, where all of her old books have been like retitled, like they have the same titles, but now say Sandra Brown. These books, when you go to Amazon, still say Amanda Quick.
Well, I think that's because Amanda Quick is Amanda Quick. I mean, it's a different kind of thing than all those old. When you talk about Sandra Brown and Rachel Ryan and Erin St. Clair, the other pseudonyms that she, or not the other, but the pseudonyms that she used, which she talked about a little bit in our Trailblazers episode with her, those names weren't as known as Amanda Quick. When you find Jane Ann Krentz has made lightning strike
a million times. Yeah.
Right? I mean, it's J.D. Robb and Nora Roberts, right? There's a sense of Amanda Quick has her own identity in historicals.
Right.
And so why would you gum it up by changing the name? Literally, the legend is, and I mean, I guess it's not a legend because I think it's true. When Julia Quinn chose her pen name, she chose Quinn so that she would be next to Quick on the shelf.
Which is a good move. Very smart.
I mean, we've all done that in sure. some way or another, like really made a lot
of us. You are really looking to be next to it. Debbie May Comer. Sorry.
Well, as you know, we are so similar.
Here's the thing, though. She's still writing books as Amanda Quick, right? Like, she has a whole new series of, recent series of historicals that have gorgeous covers that are all mm-hmm. set in, the 1920s.
Yeah.
So, you know, I mean, this is also, she's kind of kept those.
She's a legend. Yeah. She's a legend.
Well, and when you read this, you're going to know why.
Yeah. I mean, so here we are. We're reading Ravished. It's part of a series of these one-word titles.
Yes.
Ravished. Each one as delicious as the
Surrender.
Next. Surrender. Yeah, there's Rendezvous.
Rendezvous. Yeah.
So you can go and read all the other books in the series, and you will be equally as delighted as you were here. And I had a lot of thoughts while I was reading this mm-hmm. that were unrelated to Vossels, because I feel like in so many ways, this is one of those books that changed historicals.
Yes.
Or maybe it's not this book, but this series, this time period, this woman kind of did a number on historicals in a very cool way. So I want to talk about the Blue Stocking, because I feel like Harriet is primordial Blue Stocking.
Was this, before we go, I guess, into this, was this the first Amanda Quick book then?
Ravish is the fifth mm-hmm. Amanda Quick book. And I don't know, I'm going to guess the 25th or 30th Jane Anne Krentz book. I mean, a lot of books have happened here. Oh, because here's a list of all of her. She wrote as Jane Bentley, Jane Castle, Amanda Glass, Stephanie James, Jane Anne Krentz, and Jane Taylor. I mean,
right.
I don't know how you keep that straight.
Well, I'm assuming your publisher did.
I mean, all the Amanda Quicks were at least all the historicals.
Yeah.
So this is the original, this is the original kind of blue stockingy,
yes.
questy,
You know, I'm going to introduce the word that you and I have discussed before, which is romp.
Very rompy. I had forgotten how much happens in this
yes.
book.
Yes. And I think that reason part of that's important is because this doesn't mean, this has a very specific meaning in historical. A woman, I think, who writes a rompy book like this, it currently is Lenora Bell, is an example. So, you know, kind of where literally people are ducking in hedges and, you know, running around with carriages and tucking under things. And yeah. that to me is the hallmark of one of these romps. So I think it's there's a lot of things going on here that I feel were really introduced in this series by Amanda Quick.
Yes, because prior to this, the hallmark, and this is not, listen, for those of you who are new to us, Jen and I talk a lot about the history of the genre, and we talk a lot about what was happening prior or what mm-hmm, books
right.
kind of were texts that mark a movement. And I want to just say for the record that when we say a text marks a movement, it's not that text necessarily. It's sort of a hallmark text of the shift. Prior to this, largely, historicals were big romantic adventures. And this is adventure-y. It's like a smattering of adventure, a seasoning of adventure. But there's not and now we're on a ship sailing across an ocean. And now we're, you know, and now we're going to war. And the battalions are marching. I mean, that shit predates this.
Yeah, the difference between an adventure and a romp is pacing. And what I mean by that is, one of the things I texted Sarah as I was reading this is, we talked about Gentle Rogue in season 2. And, you and I had a really funny moment where we, couldn't believe that they didn't meet until chapter 10. And you and I were like, this isn't how this should work.
Well, McNaught is famous for this, where you have to go 100 pages before they're together on the page.
In this would have, and this is 2 years later. and would have felt like such a sea change because you don't even get the letter. So the way the book opens essentially with him walking in on her, studying her fossils at her table. And there is no lead up at all. It's like, boom, they are on page together on page one. And so one of the things about like that rompy feeling is just how quick it is out of the gates and how fast the set pieces change.
Yes.
As opposed to leading up to a big ocean
boom,
voyage.
Boom, boom, boom. I felt like there's a certain amount of Lord of Scoundrels feeling in this. And I don't mean that. I mean, obviously the writing is completely different. The story is completely different. Mm-hmm. But what I mean by that is that if you remember back when we read Lord of Scoundrels, there comes a point about, I don't know, halfway through the book where you can't really, an entire book has happened.
Yes.
And you still have half a book left. In this book, I had that moment and I marked it on page 98, where I was like, an entire book has
the
happened.
The acts are so clear. Exactly. So let's start, about 15 minutes in, why don't we do a real quick plot summary and then we'll talk about it. So Harriet is our heroine. She is a dedicated fossil hunter and on her way to old maiddom, and she's happy about it.
Yeah, she's totally fine.
She's like 25 or 26, lives with her younger sister and an aunt, and they live in some little English
They live
village.
In a rectory. Father was the rector in this rectory, in this parish, on the land owned by an earl.
And she has discovered that there are brigands about. Thieves, right?
Well, she's pissed.
She's pissed because they are hiding stolen goods in a cave that she would like to explore for fossils.
Because fossils.
Because fossils.
And that's not, these are legitimate, these are real fossils, not metaphorical fossils.
We'll talk about that in a minute. So she writes a very sternly worded letter to...
Yes. She asked to speak to the manager.
Yes. And insists that his name's Gideon St. Justin, right? The Viscount.
P.S. Can we talk about Gideon? That's a great romance novel hero name.
Seriously, bring back Gideon.
I'm putting it on my list.
He rolls up and basically is like, "No one talks to me like this." And she's like, "But don't you want to solve the problem?"
Well, she basically
of the thieves
summons
the-
him. Yeah. It's the best.
It is the best. And you know what I love? We never get the letter.
No,
he refers
and
to
because
it.
What's great is on page one, she summons him, and that jerk comes.
Yes,
he's like, I've been summoned.
I apparently, right? And he doesn't
and
even really know
sets,
why.
I mean, yeah. It sets the tone
for
the whole fucking book, that first page.
Yes. So she says, you got to figure out who's hiding, stolen goods in the cave so I can go discover some fossils. And the whole first act is the discovery of who's behind it.
Yeah. Page 100. That's over. We know who did it.
Second act is going to London. Third act is return to find like the ultimate bad guy.
There are easily three romance novels in this book.
Yes.
And what's wild about it, I paused on page 98 when they reveal who the person is who's running the like stolen goods through the caves or whatever. And I thought to myself, oh my God, that's in current day, in 2021, that is enough for a full romance novel, which might be why romance novels feel slower these days. Because Jane Ann Krentz said, no,
I have more to do. Listen, I would also like to point out that we've talked about this before when you talked about Indigo, like books use romance, historical, all romances, I guess, traditionally published used to be hotter. They are kissing at 15% and have done the deed by 50%.
Okay.
And I was like, okay.
I mean, I have things to say about kissing at 15%. I have a card. I have an index card.
Look, I have notes.
Wait, are we done?
I think that's the summary. It's fine.
So yeah, okay, they bone in a cave. And then we're going to come back to boning in a cave.
On a stack of sex.
I mean, name is destiny. So they bone in a cave. And then, of course, Gideon is a gentleman.
Of course.
And a scholar. Not a scholar. She's a scholar. But he's a gentleman. And he says, well, now we have to get married, which is one of my favorite things to say.
Right.
And she says, we're not getting married, which is my favorite thing for a heroine to say in that moment. And then, of course, she's totally wrong. And so then she has to go to London to figure out how to be a wife to an earl, because that was not in the cards. And then shenanigans.
Yes.
I mean, really, this.
That's it. That's a
shenanigans.
Plot. Shenanigans is the plot. Fossil shenanigans.
It doesn't matter. I mean, it doesn't matter. It's just so, first of all, there's just too much. There's too much to sum up.
Yes.
Fine heaving bosoms. They'll do it for you.
What's the part in The Princess Bride where he's like, it's too much. I sum up. That's what we just had.
We're sponsored this week by Radish, Romance That Feels You. Radish is a comprehensive romance fiction library penned by talented, popular writers. Bottomless content, one cute app. Jen, what are you reading this week?
So I really love something that has like a super tropey hook. I am reading The Wedding Trap by Adrienne Bell, which has a woman named Beth Bradley at her best friend's wedding. And she has been making up a boyfriend for the past 6 months. And now it's the wedding.
I love it.
And everybody wants to meet Charlie. And so she convinces this random hot guy to be her wedding date. And he is actually an ex-Navy SEAL. Hello.
Of course he is.
Working for the CIA.
Whenever I have to find a fake boyfriend for a wedding,
it's a hot Navy SEAL.
He's always a Navy SEAL.
Obviously. And I was in the dentist waiting room, and I just like was reading and reading and reading, and it is terrific. But it's one of the things about Radish is those plot twists, like they really know how to sell like a real hooky kind of fun, interesting plot. And I was sucked right in. I only have a few more episodes to go.
Well, so here's the deal. When you read on Radish, you read by episodes, and episodes are often free, but sometimes cost coins in order to finish a book. And our friends at Radish have a Fated Mates listener special offer. You can go to radish.social/fatedmates and you will receive 24 free coins so that you too can read about fake relationships with Navy SEALs at weddings. And that way you can read that book or any other book or try one of the exclusive episodic series. And either way, this seems like something that if you haven't tried it and you're out there and a romance reader, you definitely should because it's pretty cool.
Thanks again to Radish for sponsoring our show this week.
Okay, so I want to talk about that kiss because you're right, it's early.
Mm-hmm.
And so here's the thing. Harriet feels real ownership over these caves, despite the fact that she does not own these caves.
She's like, they're mine.
She's really pissed off because these people are like defiling her caves with stolen goods. She's skulking around in the dead of night, trying to figure out who they are, which seems really like poor judgment on the part of a blue stocking. But I mean, what else? This is a romance novel. Of course she's skulking around in the dead of night.
One of the things I love always about the blue stocking character archetype, though, is that their quest of scientific knowledge is primary.
Over all other things. Right? I mean, yeah, I want to put that on ice because I want to talk about, I want to spend a little time on the blue stocking as an archetype. Because
I'll write it down.
Many things. Take a note.
I'm going to take a note.
Okay. So Gideon, who is gigantic. I mean,
oh, of course.
Reference is enormous and massive on many. I mean, he's basically like.
He also has a scar on his face.
He's my button, right? Like installed. Anyway, so Gideon does not care at all about fossils, which I love. At one point, I circled him. She was like, blah, 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 teeth. And he was like, oh, I'm sure that's very interesting. And I circled it and wrote Jen in the margins.
Listen, I usually am like so down with the heroine. But in this case, I was like, everything he had to say about fossils, that was me. Him just like nodding.
Yeah, whatever. I support you.
So it's important to me.
I support you. I mean, that's the joy of it over the whole book. He doesn't care at all. He never comes to care about them, but he cares about them because she cares about them. And that's love. Anyway. That's a separate thing. So he doesn't care about fossils. He actually doesn't really care about people using these caves for smuggling purposes.
No,
either.
Not at all.
Mm-mm. He doesn't care about this land. He's called the Beast of Blackthorn Hall because he's scarred and they think maybe he's a murderer. I mean, ding dong, that's amazing. literally, you get to that where it's like, you know, he killed his last fiancé, and I was like, I love him.
He also like lurks about in a big great coat.
He hulks. I love a great coat.
Oh,
I mean,
God,
it just
me
feels very billowy. If you know anything about Jen and I,
real
loving
gothic.
The Tom Hardy great coat, we've yes. imprinted the image of Tom Hardy mm-hmm. from Taboo in a great yes. coat onto Derek Craven. I think it is, if it were on a moor or a white cliff of Dover, I think we would
the great coat family tree.
Exactly.
Begins here for sure. Some of you like overcoats or top coats.
We support you.
Or vests.
But we like a great coat.
Yeah.
You know why? Because you got to be big as a house to pull it off.
And someone's going to snuggle in it later. And that's all I have to say about
someone's
that.
Someone's going to get cold.
They're going to have to use it as a blanket. Bam.
Okay. So she's skulking about in the caves. He finds her in there. And he's pissed.
Yes.
Not because she's in the caves banging out the walls, which seems like it might be dangerous, or because she, you know, she might, I don't know. Not because she's trespassing in his caves. He's pissed because she's putting herself in danger.
She's putting herself in danger.
And she's like, well, if someone has to do it.
Yeah.
He's
look
amazing.
A million times in this book, she's like, if you just would have told me your plans, this wouldn't have happened.
Exactly. I love a heroine who's like, you're an idiot. I could have helped.
Yes.
So he does what any great romance hero would do in this scenario. He decides he's going to terrify her by kissing her.
He's so big when he picks
these
her
great
up.
These big dummies.
Feet are like kicking in the air, and I wasn't sad about it at all.
It's the best.
This
He's
really
huge.
Did.
He's huge.
I imprinted on every part of this book except the fossils.
It's fine.
Yeah.
It's
sure.
fine. It's because fossils aren't necessary. Fossils are, they're sure. just the thing she's into.
Sure.
He's in love with her brain because she's into fill in
Something.
The blank.
Yeah.
And in this case, it's fossils, and it's, so since then, it's been fossils.
Sure.
But here we are. This is really, I think, this is where fossils comes from. Has to.
Oh, yeah.
Has to.
Oh, yeah. Reading this, I was completely like, oh, yeah.
Science heroine, right?
Right.
So he kisses her to terrify her. And you guys, it doesn't work.
No.
She's not scared at all.
She's
in fact,
into it,
she's like, science.
This is chemistry, I believe.
This will need more research. And so this is great. And then, so there's that. There's that sort of like big hulking man. And this is where I want to talk about blue stocking archetype versus this kind of hero, the hero that suits a blue stocking, right?
Yeah.
Because the cool thing about a blue stocking heroine, and one of the reasons why I think she starts to happen now instead of prior to this.
Mm.
Though before this, you know, in those early Garwoods or whatever, there was always like, oh, I know about herbs or
yes.
I know about, you know, they had
I'm a
purpose.
Midwife. Yeah, right.
Exactly. But this is a very particular kind of like book.
Yes. Yeah.
Bookworm, science nerd heroine. And when we talk about blue stockings, the DNA of the blue stocking is a character who holds science above everything else, like you said, and also who gets knocked back by things that are not intellectual. The
yes.
physical in response to, you know, a massive hero picking her up and kissing her. The emotional response to when people insult this man who she's only known for like 3 days.
How,
and she
yes.
just kind of starts, her synapses fire in totally new and different and confusing ways. And prior to this, whenever a heroine was confused, she was made to seem kind of dumb for not knowing. But the blue stocking is never dumb.
Another thing I really liked about blue stocking characters always was they were explicitly feminist in a way, meaning they were determined to, you know, they were publishing papers, they were, you know, joining societies that mm-hmm. had been typically run by men. They were determined to be a part of a world. And I would say, you know, you see through lines of this all the way straight through to things written this year by Olivia Waite, or, you know, written mm-hmm. by
Tessa Dare. I mean,
Tessa Dare,
there
Amanda
is no Tessa Dare without.
Right.
I mean, right. when we talk about the family tree, Amanda Quick comes
yes.
first and really starts to lay the brickwork
right.
of what these books look like.
Yes.
And I mean, there is no question that Tessa Dare is descended from Amanda
Absolutely.
Quick.
Them taking their scientific principles and applying them to the conquering of society.
Yes.
So her jaunt to London to polish herself up is like this is how you do it. So I'm going to go and I'm going to investigate and figure this out. And this is how I'm going to conquer this next yes. thing in front of me is by using
but she's
skills.
Also absolute chaos, right? Because
absolutely.
She flies in because the natural state of the Blue Stocking is sort of not like other girls in these, especially in these earlier books, like mm-hmm. really not like other girls. And so because she's not like other girls, she doesn't really function in society or in a community in the way that the community or the society requires for women, in this case, specifically, to function.
Same.
So when she is functioning, when she sort of brings her chaotic energy into mm-hmm. a room or into a cave with a hero, it's so chaotic that she knocks everyone else back. And so when he finds out that she's headed to London, he's like, oh, shit.
I better get there.
I got to get there because she is going to tear it up. And, like, who knows what's going to happen? And what's going to happen is she's going to get kidnapped and brought to Gretna Green. It's amazing.
What also felt like, yes, it really is. And I love she just, like, sits back. She's like, oh, God, when will Gideon
then,
get here?
My favorite right? is when she's like, this was a mistake. He's coming. He's going to come.
She never doubts him. Mm-mm. Before we go, but one other thing I want to add, though, about the Blue Stocking archetype here is, or, like, maybe an advancement in the historical archetype of the heroine in these books is even though she's the not like other girls part, she's not a loner, though. She has her sister who loves her and thinks she's charming and they get along mm-hmm. great. And she has her aunt and they have, you know, so I would say one way that this is different is, you know, in those 80s historical romances,
right?
You were the only one. You were literally the only one. Now you're different, but you still are surrounded. There's women in your life besides, you know.
Right. And we see this with Jessica Trent and her
yes.
grandmother. Like
yes.
there are, this is the time, you know, where we start to see heroines who have careers or passions that are supported by more than the hero. I do also want to say that my favorite line possibly in the entire book is after Gideon and she have boned in the cave, and then he's like, we have to get married, and then they're talking to her family, and she says, well, it's not like I was doing anything with my virginity.
Oh, yeah. Like, completely.
Oh, and it's so great because it's so fun and rompy and chaotic.
Yes.
And so you're like, I'm in love with this woman. And so, yeah. of course, everyone else in the whole world is going to be in love with this woman. So there are two things that I want to say about him, though, in the context of the Blue Stocking. One is, I think one of the joys of this book and one of the things that makes this book so deft in terms of the writing and the characterization is that he seems to just allow himself to let go into emotion mm-hmm. for a hero who, of course, cannot love.
Of course, never, I mean.
Never cannot love.
I can't even do that. I mean, flat out says it. I forgot about that.
He does.
Because like, she says, will you ever be able to love me? And he was like, no.
I forgot how to love 6 years ago.
Absolutely not.
Well, none of these idiots can love, right? And so, except in this scenario, right, he marches I don't know. There's so many good scenes, but yeah. early in this book, I mean, I don't know, 30 pages in, 40 pages in, there's a ball.
Yes.
Or a dance, like a country dance.
A country dance.
And he turns up, which is you know, unexpected for everyone. And he marches straight to her because he knows what he wants. And he asks her to dance.
Well, before he goes to her, he, like, stops at the band shell, whatever it's called back then, and, like, has a word with the conductor. And then he goes up and asks her to dance, and it's a waltz.
Waltz? A scandal.
I forgot about this, too, right? Like, you know,
well, how big of a deal it was. Well, because it's real Regency, right? I mean,
yes.
I will say this. I learned a lot about the Regency from Amanda Quick novels.
Oh, completely.
Right? Yes. Like, I love how she just drops, she does a lot of, she does several, like, as you know, Bob moments in this book where, you know, she'll say, he's, you know, was he a lord at that point? And it's, the response is, no, of course not. His, he was second son and, you know, that, and it right. would have been a Viscount. Like, so, and then you're like, okay, that's how titles work. And waltzes are scandalous and yes. she makes sure you know it. I mean, there's a lot going on in here. Amanda Quick is layering in a lot of the rules of Regencies and really building for a lot of us the code of Regencies, the codes yes. that become bedrock to historicals. Because again, prior to this, historicals were more, like, I don't want to say primitive, but they were. Like, there was a kind of
prototypical.
There was a wildness to a historical prior to this, where it could be that you're in medieval England and you're about to go into some sort of jousting match and someone's going to get a splinter in the eye. Or it could be being wrapped in a kilt in the Scottish Highlands. Or it could be sailing across an ocean. But suddenly, with this book and the others that are coming out right around it, it's like the walls are being built in some ways. Like, Regencies look this way now.
Regardless of the time in the cave in Act One, the turn to the ballroom is inevitable.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that's because anytime you have a character who is an outsider to society, as Gideon is,
mm-hmm.
part of these books is about bringing him back into the fold, right? And he can't come back to the fold without this woman who's going to suddenly a path appears.
Well, I mean, what's interesting is that this is what I was saying about, this goes back to what I was saying about him giving himself over to mm-hmm. just the universe in a lot of ways. He says in the cave, he says,
I believe in fate.
You're my fate. I feel like you've always been my fate. And first of all, swoon.
Oh, yeah.
I mean, because this man, this sort of immovable, impenetrable, scarred, brutal hero, or we're told, you know, to believe all these things about him, giving himself over to the concept of a fated mate?
Yes.
Stop it.
And how delicious is this when it is paired with science?
A perfect knitting of two characters who... So this is a good example. So one of the things I was thinking about constantly in this is... This is a great example of how to do conflict with two people who really like each other.
Yes.
From the jump, they like each other. This is really friends. I mean, it's not friends to lovers because they're making out fast. But there's no emotional conflict here. Even when he's like, I can never love. I'm, you know, broken in all ways. She's like, okay, well, I mean, that's fine. I can love you. Like, there's something really refreshing about this couple who are, it's me and you against the world.
Sometimes you get we have to be married. Like, he understands that immediately. The minute the tide comes in and they're stuck in the cave overnight, he's like, okay, well, I see.
It's happening, so we might as well, though.
Yeah, which is great. He's like, let me empty out all these sacks so we have something to lay on.
Yeah.
But she doesn't really realize it till the next morning. But she is also understands the limitations of the world that they live in. And so then it very quickly, instead of fighting the marriage, it becomes, how can I be the best wife?
Yes, but first, before that, it's, oh, it hadn't occurred to me that if I turn you down, then the world will look at you and they will say, oh, your reputation, he remains a beast. Like, she cares for him in that moment. And then later, like way at the end, she says, I've loved you from the start. That's why I let the cave happen.
Well, and I think what I really liked about that moment is often when we get this, like, we must get married, it's like a trap and he has no choice. But in this case, they are both taking their responsibility seriously. It's just what that responsibility is different.
Yeah.
Right? And I think that's a brilliant way to, like, really, like you said, like, these are, move these characters forward in a way that, like, both of them agree to something for their own reasons, but it's so good, right? I mean, I just feel like it's so good.
It's just it's partnership from the jump, Jen. I mean,
and then it's defining the partnership.
Yeah, they are working together in support of each other from the jump.
Yes.
And that, I will tell you, you guys, as a writer, is so hard to do. And it's
so easy.
She makes it look like she just sat down and it poured out of her.
A part where I really tuned into that was, of course, there's like a bad guy and she gets trapped by the bad guy in the basement of the fossil museum. And I won't spoil it, but after she gets away and is heading home, she thinks to herself, there's no way I could tell Gideon what happened because he will freak out and I'm going to have to keep it to myself.
Well, this dummy, I mean, there are just duels constantly. Everybody, he's threatening everyone with duels. I might add, he has a giant scar on his face because he was in a duel and he got a rapier gash.
So this moment, and I remember thinking, like, it was a really interesting moment for me because I thought, well, to this day, I have friends who have expressed certain things to me. Like, I didn't feel like I could tell my partner this really upsetting thing that happened to me because then I'm doing emotional labor for them. Like, right? Like, this is complicated for women.
Yep.
Especially when they are in danger.
Yep.
And so I was really tuned in, like, what's going to happen? And she walks in and kind of tries to play it off, but he immediately senses something is wrong. And she just tells him everything. And I was so happy that she did, right? Like, partnership means you have to tell them.
Yes. And then, as a good hero should, he basically offers to bring her the heads of her enemies.
Yes.
And which is all we expect in the world. But she says, listen, I don't want you to be harmed. I don't want you in danger. And he listens. Here is a hero who is painted as truly a gothic monster. And then you start to realize, like, he is a truly decent partner who hears you when you speak, which is a fucking gift. Like, that is amazing. I mean, his biggest threat to her, he does none of the, like, I want to harm you threats of the prior heroes of the genre. His biggest threat, and of course, none of those heroes would harm. I mean, you know, once they're in, they're in. But he never makes that threat. The threat he makes is, if you don't listen to me, I'm going to make you orgasm so hard, you're not even going to know who you are. And she's like, oh,
is that a possibility?
And I'm like, wait, is this the first orgasm threat we've ever seen? Like, is this the first?
Well, it was also, okay, I guess can we talk about sex now?
We have to talk about that first sex scene and the orgasm.
Well, she doesn't
Or the non-existent one.
And I was like, what? What?
I was
and
so surprised. He doesn't notice.
He just falls asleep.
I mean,
right?
I'm so surprised on that, on both levels. I'm surprised. I'm actually really surprised she didn't come.
Yeah.
And I'm in no way surprised that he fell asleep. But then, talk about communication. This book is like a handbook for relationship communication. She says, well, it's fine. I mean, I believe in you. It was okay. Hard ground. We were in a cave. You're very heavy. we're not in his POV. And the one thing I want, McCreeve braining, presumably, of course. Right? Static. Static.
So sweet.
Yeah. Because I want you to imagine this man probably has never had a woman say, that was mediocre. Yeah. And she's not saying that. She's just like, oh, it was fine, but it wasn't, you know.
Well, and she's so into being with him.
Yeah.
But still, he didn't, seal the deal. I was amazed. And so he is like,
I am committed to this new task of mine.
Doing better, yeah.
And then he does better. Bless him.
It was amazing. I really was.
Look, the sex is great.
Yeah.
But I mean, you could have knocked me over with the, she didn't have a virgin.
I know. I know. I felt the same way. I was like, wow. But honestly.
But then he does the business and he does it well because she told him. And this is another one of those moments where I thought, well, that's transformative text for so many women.
Yes.
Absolutely. Reading, like the idea of telling your partner that you did not have a, super pleasure in your experience with them, that's a tough thing to do for a lot of women, especially, though I'm sure many people struggle with that.
Sure. Yeah, I was really amazed by it. I just in general, I would say, the pacing of it was so interesting. I was like, yeah. He was like, look, we're going to get married, so we're just going to go ahead and do it. And there was no, well, maybe I shouldn't. Maybe we should wait till 73%.
No. But also, can we say, I mean, she really handles that great. The marriage piece is so interesting because they're getting married, and initially he's like, I have to go. His father is getting sick for, you know, romance reasons. And then, so he leaves her, and as he's leaving, perfect. She's with her sister in the house, and he comes over and he says, look, I gotta go. My dad's sick. And she's like, oh, I hope he's okay. And he's like, well, he's always been okay before, so don't worry about it.
Yeah.
And then he says, he sort of looks at her and he says, I assume you will tell me if there is something I need to know and we need to get married super fast,
pregnant.
If you're pregnant. And she knows what he means. And she's like, yes, I will tell you. And then he kisses her like, crazy.
Oh, yes. Just
And then he marches out of the room and her sister's like, whoa.
I know.
Was that for real?
Fantastic. It really was.
So what I like about that is, so then he's off to wherever.
Mm-hmm.
And then he finds out she's gone to London. And she writes him a letter that's like, I'm going to London to be a good wife. And also, I'm not pregnant. So then, okay, and he's disappointed because he's like, oh, I wanted to marry her fast. He doesn't care about the kids, but he's like,
we can get married faster.
If she's pregnant, we can get married super fast and then we can sleep together all the time. I can have her with me all the time. And
very Reese Winterborn.
Too bad, not pregnant. And then she goes to London and then he turns up in London and she's been abducted to Gretna Green by some, you know, idiot nobleman.
Her friends want to save her.
Who believe that she shouldn't marry the beast. And so he's like, oh, now I got to go get her on the Great North Road toward Gretna Green. And he catches up with her. And then he's like, look, no, we're going to tell the innkeeper we're married and we're getting married.
Yes.
And she's like, okay.
You know what I loved about this book is, and I get that there are reasons that characters can mistrust each other.
Mm.
But I loved the trust that she had in him.
Mm-hmm.
And I loved how important it was to him. So one of the things so he's like this pariah in society. And she sort of is like, who cares? And he's like, you would care if you have been through what I've been through.
Yeah.
And he sort of lists it off, right? Like, my parents didn't believe me, my family, everywhere I go, I can't go into these places. And it's really kind of heartbreaking, all that he experiences. And it really, I thought, was powerful because there's so many times when we see a hero be like, who cares what society thinks? And so when she, at some point, is sort of like, So basically, he's been accused of ruining a woman, and then she kills herself, and everyone holds him responsible. And she was like, Deidre was this woman.
Including his family. I mean, yes. He really is alone.
Yes. And she's like, obviously, someone else. Deidre was carrying someone else's baby. He never, ever, ever would have left a woman like that. And what she's basing that on, and this I thought was really important, is look at the way he has treated me. And instead, we've talked a lot in some romances, it's kind of like, well, this man is good because of the way he treats me, but I don't care how he treats other people. Mm. This is the opposite. This is the way he treats me, so I know that he would never treat anyone this way. Mm-hmm. Like, does that make sense?
Yes. And on top of it, he thanks her. He's just like, there's no, and it's not like, oh, thank you, no one's ever believed in me. It's like a moment where he sees, they see each other. Yes. He's like, oh, I see that she sees me. And thank you. Thank you for saying that. Thank you for believing in me.
And you didn't need evidence. You just knew me.
Yeah, and it works both ways. And there's a moment where Amanda Quick actually flags it in the text. And I mean, I don't know because I wasn't in romance discourse when this book came out, right? But there's the moment. So they're on the Great North Road. He comes running up behind the carriage because he's, a superstar. There's a whole thing on the road. He pulls her out of the carriage. He challenges the people who abducted her to a duel. She says, no duels. It was just a misunderstanding, she says.
Right.
And, everybody, the biggest complaint that we have in romance is, well, misunderstandings. They're so silly. Why didn't people just talk it through? And in that moment, I realized that in the hands of an alpha from the 70s and 80s and early 90s, but 70s and 80s, he would have said, you must want to go.
Yeah.
You must have wanted to go with them. I'm angry with you.
I'm angry with you.
And them. Or he would have misplaced his anger with them on her. There is a she says there's a misunderstanding. And of course, what she means is, oh, well, they weren't really. I certainly wouldn't have married him. I mean, this wasn't going to end up the way that it ends up in a novel. But in that moment, using that word made me really ping what the misunderstanding in that moment could have been, which is you must have wanted to go and then we're in a fight.
Or also that this idea that they can't understand us. I understand you and you understand me, but to outsiders, and we say that a lot, like you can never understand anyone else's relationship or you can never understand anyone else's marriage. And there's all these moments where we see like the outsiders looking in, wondering how these two work, but we as the readers see how these two work. Mm-hmm. And it really felt like a prime example of like the glory of romance to me. Like, this is what I want, right? Mm-hmm. Like, this is why I read it, because I like just want to see it working.
Well, it is two people in a phone booth.
Yeah.
In a lot of ways. I mean, there are a myriad people all over, mm-hmm. but these two characters are just together and they're, it feels like you're in their little bubble with them. It's really glorious.
Yeah. I like that, he wasn't perfect. Like, there was a way that he, like, a couple times he sort of, like, shows her off to everyone. And her sister is like, he's showing you off to everyone. And she's like, well, I don't like that. But she tells him, right? Or there's a great part where she gets so pissed at him that she's going to decides to give him the silent treatment. I mean, listen, I laughed.
And he's like, oh, I'm sure this will last.
Right, where, there's like a great scene where like, someone else is like the anger translator. But I laughed so many times in this book. This book was so charming.
It's delightful.
This book is literally like it is, reading this again, I was like, no wonder I love this. No wonder I love this.
Yeah.
No wonder I still love it.
I mean, I really, now I want to read all the rest of them.
Oh, God, yes.
I want to go back to, the other one that I really loved was Scandal, and I don't remember why I loved it. I just, I remember that was the one I read over and over and over again. And then, of course, she also did. She's the, you know, the precious text writer, too. The, you know, precious book is the MacGuffin. I mean, these are, they're all MacGuffins. That's what the issue is with you. When you say fossils, that's what we're talking about, right? We're talking about, so in a lot of stories, I mean, this is a really common storytelling is function, right? Where, or a storytelling trope, I guess, where, you know, there's a quest or there's a heist or there's a thief on the page and they have to, so if you, you know, if you put a thief on the page, they have to be stealing a thing. And the thing that they are stealing is kind of often when we say, when it doesn't really impact the story or it doesn't matter that the item doesn't matter. It's just, it could be anything. We call it a MacGuffin. And so fossils are a MacGuffin in this. It could be, I mean, but you don't feel that way because they're so richly packed into the Blue Stocking character.
Mystique,
yeah. But like, truthfully, Harriet could have been interested in anything. She could have been interested in, I don't know, botany.
Right. Well, I'm sure one of the other ones is.
I've written a character who was interested in botany. So.
I'm sure. I mean, I have a dead orchid in my house, whatever. I used fossils in a Twitter thread once to talk about the difference between, like, essentially, like, when are, what, I think the ultimate question for me is, like, what I am interested in is characters. I'm not interested in fossils. And so sometimes I think what authors are prone to do in a book like this is mistake how much work-related whatever it is.
It's info dumping.
Yes. And I don't actually want to learn about fossils. I mean, this whole time she's, like, really obsessed with, like, a fossil, a tooth she found. Her tooth, my tooth, my tooth. Mm-hmm. At no part in the book do we ever discover what the tooth is. She finds some big fossil at the end. I didn't care. Like, I didn't actually ever want to read her papers about the tooth or what mattered, right? Like, none of that mattered to me. And so, and I feel bad because I think—
I mean, I don't think you should feel bad because I don't think Amanda Quick wants you to care about the fossils. I think Amanda Quick wants you to care about Harriet caring about the fossils.
Yes.
And that is because you are Gideon. I mean, you, Jen, really are Gideon, but I mean, me too. The fossils are there so that we can see Gideon care about the fossil so that—
Because he cares about her.
To show that he cares about Harriet, right? It's Winterbourne with the orchid. I mean, it's Reese Winterbourne doesn't give a shit about orchids.
No.
But
he cares about Helen.
And so he learns about orchids.
I mean, I think I took some flack for it.
Because people don't, because Twitter is stupid. Literally no one is saying your book is bad if your character's like fossils. Or, I mean, we've just done an hour of talking about this book that we both adore. That's not what you're saying. What you're saying is that sometimes writers get in the weeds about fossils.
Yes.
And I will tell you a story about my own writing.
Good.
Which might help you.
Tell me.
Everyone to understand that Jen is not saying don't write about fossils. I wrote a book called 11 Scandals to Start to Win a Duke's Heart. And in it, there is a infant. An infant is born. It's not a relevant, it's not a useful infant. It's just an infant. I mean, later in a future book, she's important, but in this book, she's not. And the hero, who is, you know, a stuffy Darcy-esque character, stumbles upon this infant in, you know, the course of the book, and this infant is having its diaper changed. And it was 2011 when I was writing it, and I was like, well, let's learn about diapers. Like, what does a diaper look like? What do we call it? How does it work? When do they change? What do you do? Whatever. I learned, like, 3 days. I did 3 days of research on, you know, the history of diapers. Packed it all in there. Because, I mean—
Sure.
Well, I know it, so you must really want to know it. Also, there's that instinct as a writer to say, like, look what I learned.
Yeah.
Delivered the manuscript to my editor, who very delicately circled the entire 2 pages where I talked about diapers and just crossed them out.
Yep.
Because it's fossils. Like, because when you write a romance novel, you know, You don't, nobody needs to know.
So it's a really, it's like a characterization issue for me. And I think the thing that I...
Yeah, what mattered was that he stood in the room while the child's diaper was being changed, which is not a thing he ever would have done before that moment.
And I think that that's why, we talk about fossils on this episode, or we're talking about actual fossils, but we talk about fossils on the podcast, we're talking about times when non-essential information takes over for characterization. And that's the thing. It's like, one of the things I've noticed is that it tends to happen more when the characters are women, because it feels like, and I've seen it happen on Goodreads, where people are like, well, how could this person, like, you have to prove,
look,
this woman is a professional or whatever.
That's so real too.
She knows her Excel spreadsheets, but Christian Grey could just sit in an office, yeah, and we are told he's a billionaire and we believe it.
I wrote a heroine who owned a business,
yeah,
owned a shipping business. She is in her office multiple times, yeah, over the course of the book. And I got so much criticism that she didn't work enough. We never saw it. And I was like, how much more time in an office do you want? The answer is none. You want none more time in an office.
And that, I think, is like an ultimate, like, I'm not saying I don't care about women's work and the things that are important to them. What I am saying is you don't need to prove to me that this woman knows her business.
Yeah, trust that the heroine knows.
I don't need that. And I don't care about it, right? I don't, no offense, but everyone else's job is kind of like...
I will say this. This is definitely used, right? This is how you can tell the difference between fossils and fossils. In this particular case, Harriet is into fossils, right? She's been chipping them out of a wall in the cave. She's used a hammer. She knows her way around a hammer. And at some point, she has to use that hammer on a person. And here's the thing. In that moment, you're like, ah, that's why Harriet has had fossils this whole time. Right? Because she needed at some point, I mean, I don't think this is like she needs to hammer someone in the head and therefore what could it possibly be? Like she could be a carpenter or be into fossils. But more importantly, like it's all tied together. It's stitched together in the writing of the book. Harriet's into fossils. At some point, she's going to have to defend herself. She's obviously going to have to use the hammer that she uses to chip fossils out of the wall. And that's a moment where it all seamlessly, you know, threads together and you think, oh, that's great. It doesn't feel like fossils.
When a gun is fired, it reveals some fossils for her. Great.
Yeah. Yeah.
But I mean, and so that's it. It was interesting. I think it's interesting what authors feel like they have to prove to their readers, maybe.
It's not conscious, I don't think, for most of us, that we pack in all the info, especially in historicals. I don't know. I don't write contemporaries, but in historicals, we do so much research.
And you found something cool.
And then you find something cool,
right?
Like, you know, how an indoor swimming pool in the 1820s would be filtered. And then you write it all into a sex scene. And then you think, gosh, that doesn't seem like it should be there. And then you like pull it all out because all that really matters is that this hero likes to swim because he, you know, has a dirt problem. But the thing is that the info dump is something that I think historical writers have to deal with. I mean, I info dump in every manuscript and then I hope I pull it back enough. There's no perfect way.
There was one part here that I did really like that was clearly like researched, right? Which is when she's in the museum.
Yeah.
She sees that he has been like sold a fake fossil that's like pinned together.
Mm-hmm.
And it's like one sentence where you're like, okay, now I guess I learned a little something about how people fake fossils.
Yep.
Fine.
And I'll tell you what, I would guess that there is a lot on the cutting room floor here.
Absolutely.
Because it's clear Amanda Quick knows about fossils now.
How sad for her.
I mean, and we know this from her. I really loved her book, her most, I haven't read her most recent book, but I think it was like the first book in this new series, which is set in the 40s in Hollywood, or the 30s mm-hmm. or 40s in Hollywood. And I really, really loved it. And part of why I loved it was because it just felt so richly researched. Like, there was so much peppered in there. And right now, historicals are going through a tough time, right? There's a lot of this push-pull of, like, historical accuracy. How much do you put in? How much do you not put in? You know, and I do think there is a delicate balance between boring your readers, for lack of a better, I mean, that's harsh, but real, and also making sure that it feels like the research is there and the historical piece is correct.
Look, I love this book, but I will tell you what, like, at the end, when she, like, wrote her journal about whatever she discovered in the cave, there was, like, no part of me that was curious at all about, I was like, I don't know, it was like a dinosaur, a crocodile, something, I don't
You're
know.
You're a Philistine, that's what the problem
I
is.
I am, I'm Gideon. Okay, I have a couple follow-up things. I don't know if you do, too.
Yeah, yeah.
One other thing that was really deeply interesting to me about this book is it was a true standalone. None of the secondary characters become characters in future books.
Really? Felicity doesn't get a book?
I do not think so.
Wow.
Right? And I think that now that would have happened, I think all of these, from what I remember, were not really related. They weren't trilogies. They were, and I guess that makes sense, because if they're blue stockings and her sister isn't one. So I just thought that was kind of interesting that they are like related thematically, but not.
Yeah, that's interesting.
By characters. So I just wanted to, that was the other thing on my list.
That's fascinating, especially because at the time that wasn't what was happening in historicals. I mean, we were families and friend groups, et cetera, were all just squarely starting, happening yeah. all the time. I mean, this is right when, I mean, Derek Craven has a connector book. Lisa's writing books that are all connected. The Lawrence books, the Sinster novels are all like.
Well, those were later, though. This is 92. It's more like Garwood.
The Montgomerys, the Mallorys, the Westmorelands.
So I just wanted to throw that out
it
there.
It is interesting because there are these sisters.
Yeah.
It's ripe for, and I think now, if this book existed now, an editor would be like, no, the next book is Felicity.
Absolutely.
Yeah. Interesting. I wonder if they dance by.
I was wondering that,
like,
too.
I wonder if Gideon and Harriet dance by.
In future books.
Yeah. By the way, I didn't say this then, but the book that I really loved, oh, it's not an Amanda Quick. Yes, it is. It's an Amanda Quick. Mm-hmm. It's labeled Jane Anne Krentz, but the name on the title is Amanda Quick. So I will say this. The book that I really loved of Amanda Quick's most recently about Hollywood is called The Girl Who Knew Too Much.
Mm. One last thought. I think I said this last time or when we talked about this book. The other thing I vividly remember when I read these books was like how hard she was working to really make like the least sexy name seems sexy, especially for the heroines. Like, it was like Harriet and, you know, I don't know. Like, oh, they all had names.
Well,
I
they
remember,
had, like, blue stocking names. Yeah.
Yes. Like, I literally remember being like, these are not the names of romance heroines. These are, you know what I mean? Like, Harriet.
Yeah.
I mean, bless you out there to the Harriets, right? But I just remember being really thinking, like, Prudence. There's right. one called Prudence.
Augusta.
Right? That these were, like, she was really leaning in hard to.
Well, to be fair, this is also historical, a real historical moment where these are real names.
You know what it reminds me of is, I think I mentioned this once, I interviewed Vanessa Riley, who said she keeps a list.
I love that story.
Of, like, men's names from this time, and she is, like, determined to use them even though they are, like, one was, like, Busick or whatever.
I love
right?
it. I yeah. love it.
Yeah.
It's great.
It is great.
Yeah, I don't know, man. This just reminded me how much I love historicals. I really do. This book is bananas.
It was great.
It just takes off like a shot. And then we're in caves with smugglers, and then we're having sex while the caves are flooding. And then there's, you know, Gretna Green and 52 duels and stolen people and gunshots, and it's wild.
It is wild. It's great.
It honestly is all I want.
Yeah.
I just want every book to be this bananas.
Well, Bombshell. I mean, I feel like you're really returning to those roots with, like, your new series, right?
I mean, that is the hope, right? That I just want it to be fun. I want it to be fun like this. Yeah. And the trick is, I mean, I really feel like rereading all of these Amanda Quicks is a good job for me, for work, because it feels like what she does is she really creates two characters who care about each other, who are falling in love. It's so emotional. The sex is so good. Like, all of it feels like a roller coaster. And then on top of it, there's this just to the wall plot. It's wild and really, really fun. So if you didn't read it, if you're one of those people who listens to the podcast without reading the book, do yourself a favor. Did you listen to it in audio?
No. Is it good?
I don't know.
I mean, you know what? I will say I didn't look. Sometimes books, it's really interesting. We've talked about this before. Sometimes books were recorded a long time ago. Then they haven't been re-recorded. And I feel like sometimes you can really tell that they were, I don't know, audiobooks have come a long way.
This audiobook is 13 years old, yes. So it might be.
They used to just be readers, and now I feel like we're getting, like, voice actors. Mm-hmm. And, you know, they're doing voice. And so I cannot speak to this one in particular, but I have found that sometimes they re-release them and they're better. So.
All right. Well. Random House, that's Jen asking you to have Mary Jane Wells.
Mary Jane Wells, everybody. Listen, Mary Jane Wells. Oh, my God. God, please. That would be amazing.
Listen, I listened to the tavern scene in Bombshell because I was curious as to how you read that out loud. And
She did a great job.
She did a great job. I was like, this is good. Who wrote this?
Oh, Sarah.
Anyway, I'm so glad you liked it again.
I loved it.
Everyone, you are listening to Faded Mates. So, Jen, next week is another Trailblazer episode.
Yes.
A good one. Nisha Sharma texted us. I'm outing Nisha. Nisha Sharma texted us and was like, who else is on the list? And we said, no.
It's a secret.
And literally, I don't think anybody knows the whole list.
No.
There are a couple people in romance, obviously, who have to know the list because we need them to help us. But it is a secret, and it is a secret because we want you all to be as excited when we announce them as we were when we heard from these people saying, let's do it. So that is that. There will be no list. We are collecting your ideas. People are DMing us with who they think they should be. And I will say some of you are already going to be very happy.
Yes.
That said, we have a Trailblaze episode next week, then an interstitial, and then we are reading Hannah Khan Carries On by Uzma Jalaluddin, and it was one of my favorite books of the year.
So exciting. You can find us on Instagram at FadedMatesPod and on Twitter at FadedMates. At our website, FadedMates.net, you can find information in show notes. You can find links to all kinds of merch, our previous episodes, transcripts, and pretty much anything else you are looking for. We hope you have a great week and that you learn about some fossils, read about a blue stocking, or wear a greatcoat. Have a good one, everyone.